Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to The Powerful Patient. I'm Joyce Graff and I'm delighted to have you with me again today. Today we're going to talk about a topic that can be very emotionally wrenching for all concerned, and that is miscarriage. And having one miscarriage is bad enough. Having more than one miscarriage is really particularly trying. And something like 20% of all pregnancies end in spontaneous miscarriage, usually within the first trimester, within that first 12 weeks. So we're going to talk today about some of the things that cause miscarriage and some of the things that maybe we can do if you're having more than one miscarriage. So we have a special guest with us, which I'll introduce to you in a few minutes. Right now, I want to tell you a little bit about our sponsor. The VHL Family Alliance brings you this program every week. We are an organization of people with one particular genetic flaw that can lead to tumors of a number of different organ systems. So let me play you a little bit about VHL, and you'll know then why we've learned a lot about dealing with a complex medical condition. And we're sharing with you the kinds of things that we've learned and exploring other related issues, one of which can be miscarriage. So let's listen a little bit to information about VHL, and we'll be right back. And I pushed the wrong button. Here we go.
Von Hippel-Lindau disease, or VHL, is a genetic condition involving abnormal growth of tumors in some parts of the body. VHL occurs in every ethnic group worldwide. At this time, there's no cure, but research is helping those afflicted and their families learn how to manage their disease. When a family member has a tumor, it affects everyone in the family. VHL Alliance works to improve diagnosis, treatment, and the quality of life. Finding tumors early, getting the best treatment, and sharing information with others to help them cope is what VHL Alliance is all about. They're available to help lessen the stress of living with this lifetime chronic disease. Support the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Alliance at VHL.org. That's Very Happy Life, VHL.org. 1-800-767-4-VHL.
Thank you and welcome back. We have with us today Dr. Carolyn Kaplan. Welcome, Dr. Kaplan.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
And Dr. Kaplan, you're with Georgia Reproductive Specialists, is it?
That's correct, here in Atlanta, Georgia. We have an in vitro fertilization laboratory, and we see patients.
Go ahead.
We see patients with all types of infertility problems, and we see patients with repetitive pregnancy loss, and we see patients with all sorts of hormonal problems. I certainly do see patients with genetic problems such as von Hippel-Lindau disease, and the gene has been identified.
Your specialty is reproductive endocrinology?
That's correct.
So endocrinology is mostly about hormones, is that right?
And right. Endocrinology.
What kinds of?
Reproductive endocrinology is a subspecialty within obstetrics and gynecology. So I'm board certified in obstetrics and gynecology, but my subspecialty is reproductive endocrinology, and so that involves caring for all aspects of women's health care as it affects their reproductive system, hormonal problems, including the thyroid, the pituitary, the ovaries. We see patients with polycystic ovarian syndrome. Most of the patients I see are trying to get pregnant, but many patients have no problem getting pregnant, but have unfortunately lost multiple pregnancies and come in search of help to try to prevent another miscarriage. It's one of the most difficult things that I see.
Right, and there are certain hormones that we need in order to sustain a pregnancy, right?
Absolutely. The ovary produces estrogen. Estrogen is necessary to stimulate the uterine lining to develop, to be receptive to a pregnancy. and estrogen is required for the uterus to produce progesterone receptors, and the ovary makes progesterone after the egg is released, and that progesterone is critical for an embryo, you know, implanting, being able to attach to the wall of the uterus. Some women do have simple hormonal problems that can reduce the amount of progesterone that their ovary produces, and sometimes treatment can be pretty simple. Some women do not ovulate regularly, and they may have a combination of infertility and miscarriage, so there can be a continuum of problems, all the way from women don't have periods at all to having not completely normal ovulation, and that could affect their risk of miscarriage, all the way to hormonally normal but infertile for other reasons. And then some women seem to be completely normal in terms of their ability to get pregnant. Their hormone levels are fine, yet they still lose what appears to be a healthy pregnancy. One of the things that we have learned over many years of studying miscarriages is that, unfortunately, at least 50% and probably more like 60 to 70% of the time, there's really nothing that we can do to prevent a miscarriage because there is something chromosomally wrong with the baby. And those chromosomal mistakes are made right at the time of conception, right after the egg is fertilized by the sperm. And so it's very difficult for women to understand that there's nothing that they've done wrong, there's nothing that the doctor should have done or could have done, that in a large proportion of patients who lose a baby, the baby really would not have ever had a chance to develop and to be delivered healthy and normal.
Right. It always seemed to me that the healthy way of looking at miscarriage that my grandmother passed down was, you know, Mama Nature just said, you know, gang, we're just not off on the right foot here. Let's
exactly, exactly. And that can be very reassuring to a patient that, yes, there was a mistake. There was just an imbalance when the chromosomes lined up to divide. They didn't divide correctly. There are, you know, too many copies of some, not enough copies of another, and it really would not be compatible with life. Now, there are some mild genetic problems, such as Down syndrome, which is an extra chromosome 21 that is compatible with life. Although a lot of times a pregnancy with an extra 21 chromosome will miscarry, but many of those children do survive and are born and are often healthy, but obviously have the problems associated with Down syndrome, mental retardation, some heart problems, a variety of other physical problems. We hope that patients, if they have a miscarriage, we hope that their obstetricians are supportive of testing the fetal tissue, and they can do what's called a karyotype of the fetal tissue, and that is an actual measurement of is there the correct number of chromosomes? Are there two of the 22 sets of autosomes, or the basic chromosomes, and are there two sets of the sex chromosomes, either two X's if it's a girl or an X and a Y if it's a boy? And a karyotype will tell you if you have lost a normal karyotyped baby, then, meaning a normal healthy female or a normal healthy male pregnancy, you know, fetus, then we would certainly start to look for other hormonal causes, thrombophilia causes, meaning blood clotting problems. There are immune problems that we're learning more and more about how a woman's body relates her to pregnancy. It is a remarkable event that this foreign object with foreign antigens can develop in a woman's body and not be attacked by her immune system.
Right. So in a case where the fetus is normally configured, it has all the right mm-hmm. genetic material, mm-hmm. then the next thing to look at is what environmental things, what things within the mm-hmm. woman's body might have been less than wonderful environment
right.
for the baby to develop in.
That's
I know
right.
I have a friend who lost 5 pregnancies in her 5th month, almost in exactly the same week.
How horrible.
And then finally what they identified, which I saw on your website, the name for it, they told her to take a baby aspirin every day,
and
she's got 2 healthy little babies. Hmm.
No kidding.
So,
wow, that's pretty amazing. So we do sometimes use blood thinners. Usually we use more than just a baby aspirin, but you know, that itself is a mild blood thinner, and she may have had a genetic problem with one of her clotting factors where her blood clotted too quickly, and so there wasn't enough blood flow to the placenta, and that would have starved the baby of, you know, of healthy nutrition. So there is a whole panel of tests, and these are very well accepted causes of miscarriage. Although there's some controversy about, you know, are these really, you know, is treating this really going to fix the problem? But it is, you know, there are studies that have shown benefits to putting a woman on blood thinners if she has one of these blood clotting problems. And some women who have multiple miscarriages are at risk for stroke or blood clots even when they're not pregnant. So it is important that they learn if they do carry one of these blood clotting problems, because they may need to be on a baby aspirin for the rest of their life and be
right.
very careful to avoid birth control pills or, you know, sitting on an airplane for a long time. They need to get up and move around. They need to be aware, you know, if they have a risk factor that would increase their risk of having a blood clot that could travel to the lungs and cause a, you know, pulmonary embolus. I mean, there are a lot of things that we learn can affect a woman's health throughout her life. So it's certainly important. And if a family history exists where a family members have had multiple miscarriages, or if there's been stroke, or if there's been somebody in the family with a blood clot, then absolutely those tests should be done. And it's generally a pretty simple treatment. So that can be life-changing.
So you said there's a fairly well-accepted panel of tests.
Yes, called thrombophilia. Thrombophilia meaning abnormal blood clotting.
Right. So this would be after someone has had a miscarriage, or for anybody who's pregnant at a certain age, or when?
No, we generally would look for some reason. We would look for a family history of blood clots, a personal history of having had a blood clot, a repetitive pregnancy loss. Anytime a woman has had more than 2 miscarriages, some people would say, you know, a woman would have to wait for 3 miscarriages before doing these tests, but we generally offer them after just 2 miscarriages because it is just so difficult for a woman, and we would hate to have somebody go through another miscarriage when a simple blood test might prevent something like that. You can. There's a lot of information on our website, which is IVF.com, about thrombophilia, about how to manage, you know, some of the treatment of recurrent pregnancy loss, and a lot of information about, you know, basic infertility and hormonal problems.
So having any miscarriage is very difficult. Obviously, it's emotional because your expectations were high and now they've been dropped to the bottom. But more than that, it's because our hormones also have been involved, and your hormones were all set for, okay, we're going to be pregnant for 9 months, and then all of a sudden the hormones drop off. And
right.
so the combination of the emotional expectation change and the hormonal change seems to me to be something that really compounds everything.
Right, absolutely. And those hormonal changes are dramatic. there's no question that women have a lot of things to deal with during pregnancy, and we certainly try to support them, give them some ideas for coping mechanisms. Hormonal swings, just the progesterone of pregnancy can cause a lot of physical changes. They can have a lot of constipation and discomfort and bloating. Emotions that go into pregnancy are intense. There's a tremendous amount of change that's happening to a woman's body. There is some support. There are some studies that have suggested that emotional support can be enough to actually reduce a woman's risk of a miscarriage. Now, these are studies that have looked at what is euphemistically called tender loving care, which means that the patient is seen more often and you know, we check in with her more frequently and that sort of thing. It's difficult, you know, to look at. I've reviewed these studies, and I certainly would not say to a patient, oh, gee, don't worry, we'll just keep a closer eye on you and everything will be fine. Because it's difficult in a study like that to really have a placebo. We know anytime you do anything, there is some placebo effect. And, you know, we make people feel better by telling them that they're taking a pain pill, even if there's nothing but sugar in the pill. So it's important to try, when we do studies, to try to see if there really is a difference. If we didn't do a particular treatment, would we have the same outcome? And there's a
so we're
real...
all very complex beings, not only hormonally and in the medical terms, but we live in a complex environment of emotions and the people we live with and the things that are happening in our daily lives with our jobs and with our children and with whatever else is going on. So while having a little extra TLC from your professional team can be beneficial, it might be either improved or completely nullified by what's going on at home.
Right. Well, that's very true. We try to get the family, the husband involved, the partner involved. Some women, we have a number of patients who are lesbian couples. We try to get the partner to be a part of this process, but sometimes they feel, you know, really excluded or outside. We have single women who decide to become pregnant on their own because they don't have a partner and they don't want to wait. And so, you know, we do have a great group of psychologists in Atlanta who specialize in infertility, pregnancy loss, alternative family building, either with sperm donor or egg donor or gestational carrier sometimes is something that we have to turn to. So we have mind-body support groups. Resolve is active. Resolve is the National Infertility Awareness Group that's run by patients and is a great support group. But I think it's really important that a woman feels that she can, you know, take the initiative and make sure that she gets a thorough evaluation and that she doesn't get told, well, you know, it was just not meant to be and just try again and you'll be fine. There's a real challenge, there's a real challenge with the miscarriage literature, because there are a couple of different centers in the United States who sort of specialize in the treatment of miscarriage. And they are very zealous about belief that what their treatment, you know, their treatments are helpful and beneficial, but the problem is they have not really supported the kind of studies that are accepted by the medical community in general, meaning a study that tests not treating versus treating. And so if you say, well, I had 20 women and I gave them this expensive IV immunoglobulin and 15 of them had a healthy baby, you know, see, that proves it. Well, the problem is you don't know what would have happened if the patient had not been given that expensive treatment. And maybe, you know, something simpler, or maybe, you know, it was a genetic problem. So I really struggle with what to tell patients. And I always explain to them that some of the tests that we do are somewhat not experimental, but just simply not completely understood. And the treatments are certainly considered experimental. And unfortunately, a lot of times that means insurance companies won't cover the treatments. They can be very expensive.
So let's back up, because there are so many things in what you just said that that raise issues that I'd like to follow up on. One of them is that a lot of women now are doing their careers first, and then the biological mm-hmm. clock begins to tick louder and louder.
Absolutely.
And they decide to have baby number one at 34 or 35. I mean, my first baby was at 28, and in the old days, they called that an elderly pregnancy.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And now that's... they're starting at 35, so,
right,
you know,
right.
My mother
it used to be baby, anybody, you know. Right, it used to be anybody over 35 was an elderly primip or, you know, advanced maternal age, and you know, I see so many women who, you know, they haven't met Mr. Right, or they decided they wanted to have complete their career, or, you know, get advanced in their career before they decide to have a child, or they've just, you know, had infertility, whatever, lots and lots of reasons. But age definitely makes everything more difficult, and that's something that nobody has found a way to turn back the clock.
Right, and according to Chinese medicine, your optimal time for having a baby is between ages 15 and 28. So,
yeah.
You know,
right. Well, they're right. They're quite correct in that.
Large number of women are now in
they're
overtime.
Not,
and
that's
I should
right.
say it's a little harder to prime the pump at this point, but at least we do have ways now of at least examining what are the factors, are all
mm-hmm.
the factors lined up in the right direction, or is there something that we might be able to do to assist? But
right.
but it is almost, as you say, it's experimental. It's we're in new territory
mm-hmm.
here.
We haven't done this before. We are. And we are starting to actually freeze eggs. That's a very new technology. We have learned that there are new techniques to freeze an egg. An egg is a big cell. And so there's a lot of water in the cell, and it has never survived freezing very well. But we now have a new process called vitrification, which is a more rapid freezing technique, and we have had very good success with freezing eggs. And so we are starting to see women who are saying, okay, I'm 30, I'm 32, I'm 30, whatever, and I'm just not ready. I'm trying to get partner at the law firm, or I don't have a partner, and I really don't, you know, I don't see one on the horizon, and they want to maintain their fertility. And so egg freezing is a possibility for women. Unfortunately, a lot of women don't decide to investigate egg freezing until their fertility has already significantly declined. And
so
it's tough for a woman in her 20s. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, help me understand this. Women are born with their eggs?
That's right. That's right. Actually, a woman, by the time you are born, a woman has already lost more than half of her eggs. So they start to develop, yes, they start to develop into the ovary, and there are many, many, many millions as a mid-trimester fetus. And by the time you're born, you have probably down to a couple of million. And from the time,
So then they mature at different points during our lives, beginning mostly at puberty?
Right, right. Growth of the egg, so the clock sort of stops until puberty. The pituitary is turned off. There's very little. There is some very small amount of growth in the ovary, very small, but you don't really start developing eggs until puberty. And at puberty, growth of an egg, of a cohort or group of eggs starts. And that process continues until you go through menopause. It does not stop if you're pregnant. It does not stop if you're on birth control pills. You have the beginning, the growth process of a group of eggs is constant. And each month, if a woman is not on a birth control pill, her pituitary starts the clock of one of that group of eggs will grow to ovulation. The rest of those eggs die. They are gone. And so women think, oh, if I'm on the pill, I'll have more eggs. Well, unfortunately, that's not true. Because that
it's
growth,
not like you're conserving them.
You're
by
not conserving.
Being on the pill and
no.
Halting the menstruation.
No, unfortunately, you're not.
They're just dying on schedule.
That's exactly right. It's scheduled death, and it's just that's the turnover process. When we give fertility drugs, we're not making more eggs. We're just capturing more of those eggs that happen to be, you know, in that growth phase, where they can grow. So we'll maybe have somebody produce, you know, or mature, I should say, mature 10 or even 20 eggs. And so instead of those eggs dying off, the eggs will grow, you know, more of those eggs will grow to maturity. And so we're not making women lose eggs when they take fertility drugs or when they do in vitro, but because they'd lose their eggs anyway.
But this is just pressing some more of those eggs to mature more rapidly or within the time frame that you're interested in?
That's right. That's right. So we can collect more eggs. I'm sorry, I've got my computer stand and I'm using my nurse's office, and so somebody's sending an IM to her. So I have to tell them that this is not her, this is me.
Well, let me ask one more kind of question while you're doing that. Help us understand, too, the process of menopause is not an abrupt, it doesn't like end at falling off a cliff. It's actually a long decline that begins where? Young 30s?
Yeah, a woman's fertility actually starts to decline mid-20s. Her peak fertility starts to slow down. So that Chinese, you know, up to 28, they're pretty right on. But, you know, in the vast majority of women in their late 20s, early to mid-30s, they're very fertile. Now, I do see women who have early menopause and who are already starting to see, there are blood tests that can tell you if you have what we call diminished ovarian reserve. There's a blood test called anti-Mullerian hormone, AMH, and it is a very interesting blood test. It's produced by that early little group of growing eggs, that is produced by those antral follicles, meaning the small egg sacs. And so that can tell us if we need to be concerned about somebody's, you know, future fertility. It gives us a bit of a snapshot. But yes, we do see, and I saw a 42-year-old woman today who came in and who decided that she, sadly, she was engaged 5 years ago, and her fiancé died from a heart attack, dropped dead of a heart attack, and took her 5 years to finally, you know, she's seeing someone who's not interested in children, and she's just decided she's going to proceed on her own with a sperm donor. But her ovaries were very busy, lots of eggs, lots of follicles or egg sacs, and you know, her ovaries look like a 30-year-old woman's ovaries. But I see women in their late 30s that sometimes we don't see a lot of eggs. We can see those small, early-growing egg sacs, and that's another good way to get an idea of how, you know, what's the future, what's the five-year prognosis for, you know, is fertility likely?
So how do you see those? Is that an ultrasound? Is it a CT? What is it?
Ultrasound is very helpful. The technology has really improved. We can do all sorts of evaluations that do not require any surgery. We can see fibroids. We can look at the ovary to see how big the ovary is, how many small follicles are growing at any time, and that's a good predictor of how fertile a woman is. We can look at her hormonal status. We can see how the estrogen that her ovary is producing, how it's affected her uterine lining, the environment in the uterus. It gives us a real bioassay. It gives us a real overview of her total fertility. And that's very, very helpful. This blood test, AMH, is very helpful, and it's a great test because you don't have to be at a particular time of the menstrual cycle to do it. And the other test that we've used for many, many years is FSH, which stands for follicle stimulating hormone. That's the pituitary hormone that is produced when throughout the cycle that makes the follicle grow. The follicle is the egg sac. It's the small cyst that matures the egg. And if a woman that has to be done at the very beginning of the cycle. So that if that's just a random, you know, at some point in the cycle and it's normal, that doesn't really mean a whole lot, because as her cycle progresses and her ovary makes estrogen, that will lower the FSH. So you can't really say a whole lot about it. But if it's on the second or third day of the cycle and it's elevated, that's a very significant finding that her pituitary is just not happy with what her ovaries are doing. And so her pituitary is sending out a louder signal and trying to get the ovary to, you know, wake up and do its job. And eventually, when a woman goes through menopause, her FSH will be, you know, 100, and normal is 5 or 6. So we can see that. We'll see patients who were here a year ago, and we measure an FSH, and it's 5 or 6, and we'll see it. We'll actually see it slightly increase. It'll be 7 or 8. It'll be 9. And then, you know, we certainly start to be very concerned, and that tells us, all right, we need to be more aggressive. And you know, a lot of patients don't want to take fertility drugs. These medications often have to be given as injections. They're very expensive. But what as a reproductive endocrinologist, my job is to make sure that the patient doesn't run out of options, and that if she wants to have a healthy pregnancy, that she has the options available to her. And then she has to make the decision about whether she wants to put her body through, you know, somebody who's had multiple miscarriages. Sometimes some women just can't do it anymore. I've had patients who've said, I have to do in vitro. We have to test the embryo to see if there are chromosomal problems, because I just can't deal with another miscarriage. And we can reduce the risk of a miscarriage by testing the embryo. Because, you know, I said maybe 60% of the time you can't prevent a miscarriage because the chromosomes are abnormal. But that's not really true. We can prevent a miscarriage because we can actually test the embryo before we put that embryo into the woman's uterus. And at least we can't completely prevent miscarriage, but we can prevent the very large percentage of losses that occur because of chromosomal problems. That technology has really improved.
You can diagnose the embryo and see, does this embryo have a good chance of survival or a not so good chance of survival?
Exactly. And would it be...
And then you can just choose not to even start with an embryo that doesn't have a very good chance.
Right, exactly. And the technology has really improved in that regard. So we now have the ability to test all 22 pairs of autosomes and the sex chromosomes. And so
just to see if they're properly configured.
That's right. You need two of each. You get one from mom and one from dad. If you're, you know, if you're healthy, normal female, you'll have two X chromosomes. Healthy, normal male, you'll have an X and a Y.
But that doesn't mean that you're checking for all, any and all spelling mistakes up and down each of those chromosomes. You're just checking to make sure that all the chromosomes are present.
That's correct. Now, if you have, if you know that you carry a genetic problem, such as cystic fibrosis, sickle cell disease, von Hippel-Lindau, I know that there is has been some identification of the gene that causes it. You know, so if you can, so if you can identify the genetic cause, you can drill down and look at that specific little tiny portion of the chromosome to see if you carry, you know, if this embryo would be affected either by a recessive disease such as cystic fibrosis or sickle cell disease, meaning you have to have an abnormal gene from both your mother and your father to be affected by the disease. Or, you know, there are other diseases where you only need to have one abnormal copy to be affected by the disease. So those are tests that can now be performed on the embryo before we even put it into a woman's uterus.
Right, but of course there's a time factor here too. It has to be done within a certain period of time, right? So there's only time enough to test for a certain relatively small number of things.
Well, that has actually just recently changed. We used to have embryo biopsy on the third day of development when an embryo was almost, well, only 6 to 8 cells. And we used to only be able to test about 10 or 12 chromosomes. It was using an older technology called FISH, which is a fluorescent in situ hybridization. It's looking, comparing, do you see two little bright spots that show, you know, you have a two of a certain chromosome, or do you have three or only one? Now we have CGH, which is comparative genomic hybridization that's done with a computer chip that matches multiple spots and tells you if you have, you test all 23 sets of chromosomes. That we can do on the third day when you only have one cell, but we now have the technology that we can biopsy an embryo on the fifth day or the sixth day when the embryo has actually developed into the next stage of development, which is called a blastocyst. A blastocyst is between 100 and 200 cells, and there is actually a separation of the fetal part of the embryo, which is called the inner cell mass, and the placental part of the embryo, which is the outer cell mass. And the embryologist can actually see where the fetal part of the embryo is, and they can avoid injury to the fetal part, and they can remove several cells from the placental part of the embryo, which is so you have a lot more cells to work with. You can be much more accurate. The problem, and I mean, it is a problem. It's just one of those technology things. It takes several weeks to get all the results of these tests, so you do have to freeze that embryo after you've biopsied it. And then once you've get the results back, then the patient can come back. We give her estrogen and progesterone to get the uterine lining primed and healthy and ready. And then once we know, okay, you know, embryo number 1, 6, and 8 are healthy and normal, we can thaw 1 or 2 or 3, possibly generally only 2 embryos at a time, because we don't want to increase a risk of triplets. We thaw those embryos and we can put them into the uterus and have a healthy pregnancy. The blastocyst at that stage survives freezing very well. And as long as the embryologists have a good track record with freezing, we have a great lab. Dr. Michael Tucker is our embryologist, and he's one of the leading researchers in the field of cryopreservation. And so we have the ability to freeze the embryos, get this information, and then at a later time do the embryo transfer. And there are a lot of benefits to that.
Right.
Because...
Go ahead.
Well, one of the things that happens when a woman goes through in vitro is that we are stimulating her ovaries. We're pushing, you know, many of those growing eggs to grow to maturity. And so her ovaries get quite large sometimes. I've had patients with 20 or 30 or rarely even 40 eggs. And we don't really want that many, but sometimes a woman can over-respond. These medications can be very tricky just to find the perfect dose. So if she gets pregnant with ovaries so large, she can be really miserable because the pregnancy hormone actually stimulates those leftover cysts after we take the eggs out. The cysts, the egg sacs are still there, and the pregnancy hormone can stimulate them, and the ovaries can become very large and lots of bloating and fluid leaking out from the ovary. It's called ovarian hyperstimulation. But all of that will go away if she doesn't get pregnant. It goes away very quickly, within a week or so. So if we freeze those embryos, then it's actually a lot safer for the woman because all of those changes to her ovaries can go away. We can, and then, you know, the next cycle, when she doesn't have large ovaries, then we can do the transfer.
I see. So that is an advantage. Freezing it is an advantage because of the time to help the ovaries recover and get back to a more normal state before the actual pregnancy begins.
Exactly.
Now, let me go back and talk a little bit about the hormones. I'm picturing a woman's hormones over her lifetime as it being kind of a bell-shaped curve, if you will. So there's the time when it comes above the critical level and we begin to mature eggs in our adolescence, and then that goes on through somewhere in our 30s, usually. And so there's an average kind of a bell-shaped curve. But then you were indicating that for each individual woman, that curve could be different. It could start earlier, it could start later, it could begin to decline earlier or later, depending on the other things that are going on in her particular body.
Absolutely. And most of it's genetics, you know, so you need to know how old your mother was when she went through menopause, for instance.
Right. So some of it is genetic, but is some of it nutrition, too, these days?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Smoking, cigarette smoking, is a terrible thing for your ovaries and for your eggs. It hastens the age of menopause. So there is definitely genetic damage. That's the most important thing a woman can do.
Right. I read an interesting statistic the other day, too, that women miscarry 50% more often if the father smokes.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? So it is. It's a very powerful effect.
It's not just about the woman. It's also about the health and nutrition of the father.
That's right.
To make sure that all the genetic material, for hers as well as his, come together and are all
That's
in
right.
good order.
That's right. Cigarette smoke definitely can affect sperm and the chromosome delivery of the sperm. And it's a difficult, nicotine is an incredibly addictive drug, and I certainly feel for patients who struggle with this, and we try to help them. There's some medications that can help with smoking cessation. But yeah, that's a big one. Nutrition is certainly important. You know, in this country, starvation does not occur much, but there is some self-induced starvation. There are women who have anorexia, eating disorders, lots of teenagers who have these images of what perfect is and how they're supposed to be thin. A woman who can cause her reproductive system to completely shut down if she has poor enough nutrition and low body fat. And it's well known. If an athlete, young women who are athletes generally quit having periods. Now, you know, that and they can have bone loss because of their hormones being suppressed, and you know, a lot of problems. Obesity is another major problem, and it is a risk factor for miscarriage, and it's definitely a risk factor for fertility problems. I see lots of women who have stopped ovulating because of their, you know, partly it's genetics, but it's because of their obesity. They have high insulin levels. Insulin can poison the ovary. It stimulates the wrong cells in the ovary. It stimulates the male hormone-producing cells. So women can have, you know, facial hair and acne and a lot of side effects that are related to too much testosterone in their bloodstreams. So there are tremendous things that our environment does do. And it's tough. We have a real obesity problem in this country. We do not exercise enough. Children are getting, you know, the wrong message about healthy portions, processed foods, all of those things, I think, or do contribute. And I see it all the time, every day.
So obesity is an issue, but being too lean is also an issue.
Yes.
As you said, you need a
yes.
certain amount of body fat in order to sustain
mm-hmm.
a healthy pregnancy.
Absolutely.
The other thing I've heard is about soda pop, that
mm-hmm.
that the sperm counts in men who drink more than two sodas a day or something are like 50% of what their peers would be.
Yeah, I haven't reviewed that particular piece of information, but I would not be surprised. Phosphoric acid, caffeine's not generally a problem for men. There is some weak linkage between too high a caffeine intake and miscarriage in women. We can definitely affect our health by the things we put into our bodies.
Right. And then, as you mentioned, emotional support is so important. So for both members of this partnership, it's important
mm-hmm.
to be healthy and well and emotionally healthy as well and get along well.
Yes.
So that there's no enmity happening at home that might also contribute to difficulties
sure.
in pregnancy.
Absolutely. We really, really encourage couples to have support from their church, from support groups, from a psychologist, from their family, you know, wherever they can find it. And we really try. It's a very touchy subject, and people don't want to admit that there's stress and strife and disagreement. But we really do try to tease that out and try to get a sense of, you know, is everybody really on board with this baby thing? I don't think there's anybody who doesn't have a little bit of uncertainty about, you know, is it the right time? Or do we have enough money? Do we, you know, what's it going to do to my body? All of the things that having a child entail. It's a tremendous change, and we really want people
Maybe
to be ready.
Generally, don't fix relationships.
No. That's true. That is so true. And we have to think about the health of the baby. We really do. And so, you know, we do ask our patients to think a lot, and we require them to jump through a lot of hoops to make sure that they really, you know, have all the support in place that they need.
That's great. So for women who have complex medical conditions before they get pregnant,
yes.
there can be complicating factors that could also be problematic during pregnancy. I mean, if you know, for example, that you have a risk factor for having a brain tumor, then getting a brain tumor go to a critical level during your pregnancy
mm-hmm.
puts the baby at risk and also puts the mother at risk.
Absolutely.
So what kinds of things do you suggest to someone who may have some risk factors? Are there particularly
sure.
important things to know in advance, to be sure to communicate to your obstetric team
Yes.
so that everybody understands what the risks are and how
Absolutely.
To behave if something happens.
Right, absolutely. We have, we certainly encourage patients to look at their general health, but for people who have complex medical problems, we do try to get a good consensus between all the medical teams, and we try to communicate. We have patients who have heart problems. We have patients who have high blood pressure. We have patients who have breast cancer, or have had breast cancer in the past. We have patients, as you say, brain tumors, thyroid problems. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. All of the things that can affect a healthy pregnancy. Pregnancy is a very stressful condition. It is a dangerous condition. It can be. And if somebody
right.
has
so
a heart condition,
your,
it,
right.
it increases
your blood,
it
blood
increases
pressure
your,
to go up or your blood
it
volume
can.
To go up? Tell
it,
us about
it, yes.
that.
Very much so. It increases your blood volume. You have to have a lot more fluid. The placenta produces hormones that cause you to retain fluid. You have increase in clotting factors. Think about, you know, the evolutionary advantage. If a woman, you know, women bleed at when they have a baby. And if their
right.
blood doesn't clot so well, they tend to die. So there's an evolutionary advantage to having your blood clot more. So pregnancy is a condition where, you know, if you already have a thrombophilia, it tends to make it worse. So women who, I've had patients who didn't know they had any problem until they were pregnant, and the hormones of pregnancy caused them to have a blood clot. A pulmonary embolus. I mean, these are life-threatening. So you can't prepare for everything, but you can certainly look at your overall health, make sure you're not anemic. A woman should always be taking a folic acid supplement with a prenatal vitamin if she's at risk for pregnancy, even before she knows she could be pregnant. That has been shown. If a woman takes a prenatal vitamin with extra folic acid for several months before conception, that does seem to reduce the risk even better than if she just starts it at the time of conception to
right.
reduce
so
her risk.
It's one of those things we get from green leafy vegetables,
mm-hmm,
but
mm-hmm.
it's also water soluble, is it?
Yes.
One of those that we don't
That's
make
right.
it inside of our body, so we have to take it
you
in
have to take
almost
it in.
Every day in order to get enough.
Right, exactly. And,
right.
you know,
and it's
bread is...
in order for genes to replicate correctly without mistakes.
Mm-hmm,
right?
That's right.
And so when you're making a baby, this is particularly
very
important.
That's right. Vitamin D is getting a lot of press lately, and we're picking up a lot more deficiencies. And basically, you just need to do a blood test, ask your doctor. I'd just like to know what my vitamin D level is. There's evidence that women who are deficient in vitamin D, their children may have more problems with allergies and asthma, and there's just a lot of evidence that it may affect risks of cancer and heart disease, and, you know, besides your bone health, it's very, very important for that. And the baby is going to rob calcium from a woman's skeleton. Vitamin D helps you absorb calcium. You know, so it's important, and we've started testing all our patients who are trying to get pregnant, and we find, especially in Black women, there's a lot. They don't make as much vitamin D from sunlight as lighter skinned people, and they also tend to have more lactose intolerance, so they often tend not to drink milk. And there's a lot of vitamin D
uh-huh.
supplementation in milk. That's where a lot of people
right.
get from dairy. So looking at your overall health, prenatal vitamin, vitamin D, overall, you know, stop smoking, exercise more, regular exercise makes pregnancy easier, it makes labor easier, and, you know, trying to get into a little bit more normal health, weight range. Even, you know, for somebody who's really, really obese, sometimes, you know, they just feel like there's no way, that it's just hopeless. But there's evidence that even 5 or 10% reduction in your body weight can really reduce the risks of pregnancy. It takes a lot of stress off the heart and the lungs. It reduces the risk of diabetes. So, you know, it's really something that
losing weight,
even just a small amount,
not the crazy
right
way.
Absolutely, absolutely. It needs to be not a diet. It needs to be dietary changes that somebody can stick with. And basically, I tell all my patients, you know, avoid processed food. The more natural, the you know, if don't drink fruit juice, eat a piece of fruit. There's more fiber. The sugar is broken down more slowly to come into your bloodstream. You know, when you take a whole grain and you grind it up into a powder, you know, your body turns it into sugar very quickly. So you want whole grain, whole fruits, whole vegetables, you know, lean meats, fish, soy, peanuts, legumes, you know, beans are great. I mean, there's all sorts of ways to have a healthy diet, but we have a lot, you know, we can get away from some of the processing. I think that would be good for all of us.
Right, and nutrition is very important because, as you said before, the baby's going to get fed no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
The baby's going to
mm-hmm.
take what he needs, and if
that's
that means
right.
he gets to steal calcium from
yep.
your bones and teeth,
that's right.
The old wives' tale used to be that for every baby you lost a tooth.
Right, yeah.
The baby's going to get what the baby needs, and you're
second.
Right. So be
that's
sure
right.
you're taking in enough for the two of you.
That's right.
A couple of other little risk factors I wanted to just bounce
mm-hmm.
off of you. Kidneys, because of all the increased fluid,
mm-hmm.
Is there an increased load on the kidneys?
There is. Certainly a woman who has hypertension, high blood pressure, really needs to have her blood pressure under good control. Because the kidneys have to increase the amount of filtration that they do. In general, you know, a healthy person, there's not a tremendous strain placed on the kidneys, but for somebody who has high blood pressure or has some kind of kidney disease, absolutely, they really can decompensate and get worse. So that's important. The thyroid is very important. If you have a family history of thyroid disease, or if you're just feeling sluggish and, you know, cold and low energy or dry skin, I mean, there's a lot of symptoms that can be affected by your thyroid. It's an easy blood test to do. The baby has to get thyroid hormone from its mother. And if it doesn't get enough thyroid hormone during pregnancy, it will be born with an abnormal brain. And that's a really
wow.
serious condition. Yeah, it's
that's
really
right.
affects brain development.
We definitely want this baby to have a normal brain.
Yes.
Just one other pet one of mine. If you're in any kind of a risk factor for pheochromocytoma, be sure
mm-hmm.
to get tested for a pheo,
mm-hmm.
because it's a very strong risk factor both for the mother and for the baby. So
mm-hmm.
be sure.
Yeah, high blood pressure. Sure.
After.
Right.
Yeah. Thank you. This has been wonderful. I really appreciate your time, Dr. Kaplan.
Oh, well, thank you.
It's been delightful to talk with you. So, again, your website is www.IVF, for in vitro fertilization.com, and it's the Georgia
Reproductive Specialist.
Thank
yes.
you.
Georgia Reproductive Specialist. Yes, thank you so much. I've enjoyed talking with you.
Great. So thank you, everybody, for being with us, and I hope that you'll have a great week. And we'll be back next week with another interesting program. And we hope that you'll have a great week, and be well, and always be a powerful patient. Thank you again, and we'll see you next week.